Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And my guest this week is Charles Musselwhite. Now, Charles is a professor in psychology at Aberystwyth and he's a specialist in gerontology with a particular focus on how people engage with place in terms of age. Now, he first went to Lampeter to study archaeology back in the early to mid-90s, and Charles talks about how that experience underpinned what he thinks and researches now. We find out about the bottom-up dimension to his research, asking how someone lives their life, and we learn how, for example, when it comes to transport, well, it's more about the people than the vehicles. After Lampeter, Charles went to Southampton to study psychology. He later did a PhD looking at how young boy racers change in their lifetime. Are they still boy racers when they're older? We look at the role of nostalgia in terms of the people that Charles interviews and the views that older people who are housebound see from their windows. Charles talks about how the most interesting bits in people's lives are often the everyday, the ordinary ones, rather than the life-changing, extraordinary events. Now, Charles grew up near Portsmouth. His parents were teachers. He remembers once seeing his headmaster throwing up in his parents' downstairs toilet at 3 a.m. Now, he can still feel and smell the past as well as see it. And Charles talks about how gratifying it is when students tell you how much they learned from your teaching. Musically, Charles has always been into progressive rock, and he recounts the time that he went down from Lampeter to see Marillion in concert in Cardiff. This was back in early 1994, and how he especially remembers the most unusual of journeys there. Indeed, we move on to discuss how the journey is often as important as the destination. Then, towards the end of the interview, Charles reveals that he suffers from rose-tinted glasses syndrome, and he talks about the importance of keeping diaries in terms of correcting the way we look at things. He's not very good at parking the past. Charles tells us why returning to Lampeter is restorative, why the place is unique, and the way in which our friendships often evolve in ways we might not have anticipated. So it was just wonderful to catch up for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews with Professor Charles Musselwhite. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Charles Musselwhite for my latest nostalgia interview. And I should, of course, say Professor Charles Musselwhite, because I just learned before we started recording that you have some really big news.
Chris, you're the first person to say that, I think, out loud. That sounds lovely. Yeah, no, I've just secured a job as a chair in psychology at Aberystwyth University, starting 1st of September.
Yeah. No, that's amazing news. And of course, we'll find out in a minute whether we did actually know each other. Our paths must have crossed many years ago in the University of Wales in Lampeter. But at the moment, of course, you're based in Swansea.
That's right, at Swansea University. I am a reader in gerontology, which is the social study of ageing. I have a particular interest in, well, in research terms, around how people engage with place as they age, so connections to neighbourhoods, community, and how they get out and about, so transport comes into that. Lots of the research I do is qualitative in nature, so it's about talking to older people. I love talking to older people. It's great. You get brilliant stories. You know, it's a real pleasure and a privilege, really, to be able to talk to them. So, you know, despite lofty status as professor, I'm still going to be doing my field work. I don't want to miss out on you know, the great stories older people have about their lives and their history and where they've been. And, you know, and I've got a vested interest. You know, we want to make this good for when we retire, you know, have a nice society for us. Well, if we ever can retire, but, you know, in later lives for ourselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important, because in my case, I discovered some years ago that when I wanted to do some work, I had a study leave period back in 2017 on nostalgia. I was looking at what all the sociologists and the anthropologists and the psychologists and the theologians were saying about it. But of course, people were telling me their own personal narratives. And of course, I was thinking, God, this is more interesting in some ways. Or actually, I'll put it another way. I was finding that the individual people's testimonies were not necessarily then conforming to the paradigms. So I was thinking, oh, what you've just told me isn't what I expected you to say. So then it was only a while later I started doing the podcast podcast as an addendum to that. But then, of course, people were saying to me, but you are using this data. And I was like, no, this is like my own radio show type thing. And they were like, but you've got all this massive data. So in due course, it became apparent that almost inadvertently, I had my data set, and I'd never done that sort of empirical work before. So how did it all start for you then, Charles? How did you get into doing qualitative fieldwork?
Yeah, it's a good question, I think. Well, really, it started in my years at Lampeter University, you know, in about 1993 to 94, particularly. I was an undergraduate in archaeology, and there was two lecturers that stood out for me that I still use their stuff, or has underpinned how I've thought about things even now. Michael Shanks was one of them in archaeology. Now, is he at Stanford now, University, I think? So went on to higher and greater things, but obviously not as pretty and beautiful as Lampeter is. But, you know, his way of looking at archaeology from a much more perhaps, you know, almost postmodern perspective, and that bottom up perspective, trying to challenge that orthodox thinking around things and the positivist thinking that was beginning to dominate archaeology, you know, that more scientific approach to stuff. And I loved that. I thought that, you know, that really captured my imagination, if you like, at the time. And I didn't quite understand it completely at the time, but thinking about it now, that's, it's underpinned the way I've looked at things from now. So if I want to, you know, study the way people live now, it's just like you said, I try and look at it very much from the person perspective. It's a very bottom-up approach, if you like. So how does somebody live their life? You know, I'm not going to prescribe for them a way or a set of theories or something like that. I want to hear it from them. So, you know, a lot of the work I do is similar to perhaps what you're doing here. You know, it's just finding out about people's stories around certain things. How do they connect to their neighborhoods? You know, what's their history of connection to place and things like that? And the other lecturer at Lampeter at the time, I didn't actually have him for any particular modules at the time, but I did you know, break into his lectures, and that was Tim Creswell, who was geography lecturer at the time, and, you know, inspirational in terms of cultural geography and the way, again, sort of changing the way human geography looked at the time, which was going to perhaps a more you know, natural sciences kind of approach, and trying to you know, looking at the subjective nature of particularly for him, for mobilities again. So that's where I got that interest in transport. You know, transport at the end of the day isn't about the roads and it isn't about the cars and the vehicles. It's about the people at the end of the day and how they want to move between places and what they're doing. And, you know, that for me was crucial. So then when I went to Southampton University afterwards, you know, I did psychology at Southampton, and in the final year there was a lecturer called Roger Ingham, and he did a module you could choose on, and he did a module around sex, football and driving. So all the boys took it, you know, all the 20-year-old undergraduate males took that. But actually, it was a wonderful module. It, you know, those three things perhaps hooked you in, but it was the social psychology of them. So how do you apply theory to these real life issues? It was all about risk. So why do younger drivers drive more riskily than older drivers? You know, why do young people continue to have, you know, not use condoms when they're having sex? You know, what's the social aspects that make those things difficult? And the football bit was, you know, it was about football hooliganism and group behavior. So why do people end up behaving worse when they're in groups at football and things like that? And I loved that. I thought that was marvelous. The way you brought the psychology to life, to real life issues, and actually had something to say that could make a difference. And I thought, of all those, I really like the driving bit, so the transport bit. So that's why I went on and did a PhD in transport. And I studied how young boy racers changed in their lifetime. So, you know, you get young boy racers who drive like lunatics. So what happens to them as they age? Why don't you get middle-aged or old boy racers? And I just found there's changes in people's identity. So older people continue to like to use their driving to show that they to show something about themselves and their personality, but it was really, they do it in different ways. So they do it actually, you know, very safely and sensibly. This is who I am. I'm a very good driver in my, you know, Mercedes, and, you know, I can still drive really well. So they drive slowly and very carefully to show something about themselves, whereas the youngsters are using their car to express their independence and their personality and drive more likely to drive like lunatics. I just thought that was fascinating, and nobody else had really done, you know, a life course perspective on identity and driving behavior before. And that, and from then on in, you know, I've probably concentrated a bit more on aging and older people and collecting their stories about transport and what it does for them, so how it connects them to place and neighborhoods and things like that. So that's my background and my narrative.
No, that's fascinating, because I was only thinking the other day about, you know, looking back on people I went to school with, and, you know, you remember some wonderful people. You also think, oh, I didn't like those people. They were bullies, or they were horrible people. You're thinking, but what are they doing now? Because they may be parents, they may even be grandparents now. And you know, if they were not very nice people at school, did they have children themselves and then think, oh, actually, you know, I don't want my child to go through what I, you know, did, or does the cycle just repeat itself? And so you're right that sometimes it's easy to remember people as they were, and you forget the fact that, you know, I, and part of me still thinks the same way, I think I do, as when I was at Lampeter, as you know, when I was 18, and the same interest. I listened to the same music, and literally in some cases I listened to the same albeit digitized, you know, cassettes of stuff from the radio or whatever from those days. And then, of course, I will be 48 very soon, so, you know, part of me just steps back and just thinks, you know, something has happened generationally. And I don't know at what point, like with my students, I used to wear a tie when I was lecturing to distinguish myself from the students, because I was only a few years older than them. And I didn't want anybody to think that I was just another student in the room. I wanted to show that, you know, I was the so-called authority figure. But now, of course, I go the opposite way and I try to sort of, you know, look younger or dress younger, because I'm like, no, this is my midlife crisis. So that thing of age is interesting. So, but when you do your interviews with the older people, I mean, in that sense, I'm guessing nostalgia plays a big role in the conversations that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think later life, particularly when people have finished working or you know, they often fill their lives with lots of other things, volunteering, maybe working part-time, sometimes helping families and stuff, but you're right. I mean, they've had time to really reflect and think about their lives, and actually that seems to be quite healthy. You know, lots of research out there talking about that as a time of reflection and thinking about achievements, thinking about things that have gone well, you know, even things that where things haven't gone so well in their lives, but they've overcome them, or, you know, and thinking back is something, you know, that they've had time to do, and therefore when I chat to them and talk to them, they articulate it brilliantly. I did a really interesting project about, you know, one of my favorite projects of all time was some housebound older people who couldn't get out and about so much anymore, and they connected to their outside world through their view through their window. So they listen to the radio, watch the television, and that's really important for helping, you know, connect to the outside world. But I was interested in, you know, what does the view from a window give them that other things don't? And, you know, some of that was about reflecting on who they are now in comparison to who they were in the past. So they particularly like views where they could see other humans walking past, you know, other people walking past, connection to seeing people out and about for a stroll or walking to work or driving to work. And then they talk about themselves in relation to that. So they say, well, when I used to go to work, I wouldn't have, you know, we used to go on a bike. I wouldn't be driving like all these people are. Or it was always very much walking to work or something like that, you know, and that kept me really fit and healthy, you know. And these people these days, they're in their cars, they go from their home in their cars to work, there's no time for exercise, something like that. So that gets them talking about, you know, connecting to things that they did differently in the past. And, you know, I think on the whole, there's this idea that older people always harp on about the past being loads better than now. But in my experience of talking to them, if you talk to them long enough, they know it's not always as, you know, rose-tinted glasses come into it. You know, they know it's not always been as good in the past as it perhaps, you know, it might be viewed to be. And they really like some of the modern stuff. You know, they'd like to know more about using their smartphone better and connecting with technology. They see the people walking past using their phones, you know, they talk to their family. So, you know, they just wish they could, I don't know, engage or have the time or the understanding or the motivation to be able to use these things better. Another project we've had is connecting people to their past places through looking on Google Maps, for example. So if they use the Google Street View and they're walking down, you know, that's a brilliant way of connecting. They take friends or, you know, other people in the focus group or whatever we're doing to where they used to go, or where they used to live, or where they used to work. They take them on a tour, and it really sparks off, fascinating conversations. And they love seeing how it's changed over time. There was somebody saying, "That's the house I used to live in. I planted that tree, and now look at the size of it." And it's the first time some of them have seen these places for 10 or 20 years. Holiday destinations they do as well. It's fascinating.
Yeah, because when I started doing my podcast, I thought most the best interviews would be with the older people, because I'm talking about nostalgia and they've got a whole life to reflect on. That hasn't necessarily been the case, because of course you can have an 80-year-old who doesn't have a huge willingness to talk about or to be reflective. You might have a 20-year-old who's, I mean, it came about for me when a student of mine who was only about 18 was talking about being nostalgic for a film that to my mind was only like few years old. And I thought, what do you mean you're nostalgic from this, like, but of course she would have been like 13 at the time, and I think it was Mean Girls, and then she actually got quite upset in a lecture and actually had to leave. And I just thought, wow, I was overwhelmed by that. And of course everyone has a narrative, and of course it's an ongoing narrative, and I think that's the crucial thing, that we were all, and I've never believed, well, maybe at the beginning I thought nostalgia was about the past, but of course it's as much about the present, and something missing in the present that maybe makes us pine for, wistfully or otherwise, for something that happened that might have been, whether it happened in reality or in our imagination. So do you find in that sense that there's a lot of critical reflexivity? I mean, rather than the whole sort of, oh, it was better in my day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does. I think, even without blowing my own trumpet too much, you have to set the agenda in the right kind of way when you're chatting to people. Like you're really good at, and good radio presenters do, good interviewers do. You have to put people at ease and allow them to explore and talk about those things, because otherwise, and I always think this happens in quantitative research, when you've got statistics and numbers, you're only really scratching the surface of things. So if you don't allow them time to develop their narratives, they'll tell you the crucial key points of their life. So the things they think you want to hear, the really important things, about when they had children, or when they, and of course, when they changed jobs, or some accident they had. And that's really important. But actually, the most interesting things are the bits in between. And that's only comes when you spend time with people, or get to know them, or get them to be able to talk to it. I'm a big fan of really trying to unearth the everyday, the ordinary. And when older people give up work, that's one of the key things they really miss, is passing the time of day with colleagues, with friends, about the most mundane, ordinary things. I think, just chatting about the weather or the football results last night. If they're not going out and doing these things, they miss those everyday, ordinary things. And I think that's a real important life lesson, really, to try and make the most of just those ordinary everyday conversations. I do a bit of running here and there, although I never seem to lose any weight doing it. But when I run and I see older people walking the other way, I always try and make a point of saying good morning to them, just to say, and there's something really important about that connection with other people. It doesn't matter if they don't say hello back or anything like that, just to there's connection. But quite a lot of them do. And I think, we underestimate the importance of those sort of small, informal chance encounters, everyday situations that we take for granted in normal life.
Yeah, and you're right, because when I was in Lampeter, I was really struck sometimes by the way that, well, even now looking back, the things that I remember most, or the special occasions, and not always the obvious ones, of course, like getting your degree result, or in later years with the birth of a child. Of course, they're important, but often the things that you can't get out of your head were those evenings at the quarry playing pool, or not playing pool very well, or just random conversations with people where you felt really at ease, and you felt that you were in the company of people who really mattered, and you wanted that everydayness to continue. And that's what I miss all
Absolutely.
those years on. That sometimes actually that those big events have too much riding on them. I mean, the birth of my first daughter, but of course it's stressful because you always worry that something might go wrong, and the trip to the hospital, and and then things like the car parking. And then you find you get to the hospital and then find that you could, it's a coin only meter, and you have to top it up every 2 hours. So you're leaving the site of the birth in order to go and, fill up the hospital, those sort of things. So in my diary, although you could look back and say, oh, that was a wonderful day, you're also aware that there were things that you just didn't need to happen, which put it into a different sort of perspective. So I think that notion of everydayness is absolutely key. But for you, Charles, I mean, so obviously we'll be going backwards and forwards, but how did the journey start for you in terms of, we'll come obviously later on to your sort of academic interests and what made you go to university, et cetera. But what about childhood for you? What where did you grow up and what do you remember?
Yeah, so I was born in Portsmouth in Hampshire, within sight of the Fratton Park floodlights of Portsmouth FC. brought up on the coast in a place called Leon Solent, which is between Portsmouth and Southampton. My parents both were teachers when I was younger, so I've always had a sense of, you know, education being really important to people's lives. They worked really hard. You know, I remember in the evenings and the idea that teachers have huge holidays, they were always doing some kind of work or other. I have lovely early memories of going into their schools in holidays. Interestingly, it's lovely to have been inside a great big place where there should be lots of kids, but there isn't. And you know, you're kind of like privileged to see another side of a school. And you know, and having parents as teachers also leads you to have, you know, if my parents had a party, some of the teachers who taught me would be at that party. So I always saw them as normal human beings. I remember seeing, you know, friends of mine would see teachers slightly different, put them on a pedestal or treat them slightly differently. But I saw them, especially having parents like mine, you know, that perhaps they, you know, they're really sort of hippies, smoking, drinking. It was very hard for me to ever do anything wrong in my childhood. They were very accepting. You know, I had a very, very happy, relaxed childhood. But yeah, one that had this nice, interesting window to a different world of seeing teachers at parties drunk sometimes. I remember our headmaster of our senior school throwing up in my downstairs toilet at 3 a.m. in the morning. You know, but it just made them all a bit more human somehow. But yeah, I remember, you know, quite early on going into my dad's junior school and seeing the classroom being laid out and him doing a bit of work, but being allowed to have an exercise book to write in and things like that while he was doing a bit of work in holidays. And I remember my mum really early on directing a play for, I think it was 12th Night at the senior school she worked in at the time. And after, where, you know, it was probably when I was in infant school, and I'd go and join her after school and sit there and watch that her direct the kids in the, you know, the 50 years as they were then, or sixth form as they, you know, it was attached to it then, in this play. And I thought, again, that was fascinating. I really remember those. And I think lots of my earlier memories, and probably all of my memories, are not necessarily always about the things that took place, but I can almost smell and see and feel those feelings of the time, that the light and the, you know, especially if you think about them putting on the play, the stage with the lights going on it and things like that, I can really feel and you know, and I think that certainly made me very interested in education for always. I always thought it would be good to be a teacher. I'm actually, you know, surprisingly shy and insecure on the inside, but teaching and talking gives me a chance to, you know, explore my more extrovert side and be a show off, if you like. So over time, I've been able to do that. So I always thought I'd probably end up being a teacher or something like that from my childhood memories on that front, I think.
But, yeah, and I think you're right, because I was very shy at Lampeter in the sense that if there was a seminar, we didn't have as many seminars as we do now. It was mainly lectures, but I remember being in a class and if I wanted to speak, you know, I could feel my heart pounding. Yeah. Because, and then I realized in later years why I enjoy being at the front of a class. It's much easier to be the lecturer than the student, because if you're the lecturer, you've got 2 hours or so to let yourself unwind and unfold. And if you don't get what you want to say across, you've got plenty of other opportunities, because you're in charge of that group for 2 hours. But if you're the student and you got your hand up, you might just have 10 seconds and you're competing with 30 other people in the room. And even to this day, I thought, how can I stand up without being terribly nervous in front of all these people? And then if I'm in a room with my peers and I put my hand up, or it's my turn to speak, and suddenly, you know, gobbledygook comes out, or I speak too fast. And I thought, I'm better than this. How can this be? And I think it's the context. I always use the example of the supermarket. You know, you can be at the checkout in the supermarket and have a very awkward conversation about what you do for a living. And you talk about religion, and goodness knows where that conversation sometimes leads. But I can happily talk comfortably for 2 or 3 hours that same day with my students and talk about some very sensitive topics and challenging topics, but feel that I'm very much in my comfort zone. So I think it's the particular way in, and it's the audience and also the role that you're playing, being an adult or a parent rather than a child.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really enjoy that about teaching, that it feels like, you know, you really are helping people. You've got something to say, to give to those people that they might go away and be inspired with. And, you know, that's the best thing about the job, is when students tell you that they've changed the way they think in, or they come back years later to tell you that they've, you know, been inspired by something that you've presented to them. And, you know, it's not always my own work, but it's presenting other people's own. It's just got them to think a little bit differently about who they are and their life, you know, not necessarily their work or their jobs, but just about changing their view on things. And you know, I love that. There's been some real success stories as well of seeing students mature through undergraduate to postgraduate to being researchers, or seeing them out getting a good job. And, you know, some connection with that is really nice. That's why I really like the idea of having a 3 or 4 year undergraduate course, because people develop and mature and change so much. And you think about when I was, you know, an undergraduate, I'm always really terribly embarrassed about it, but I never completed the degree at Lampeter. I was there 2 years, and I was immature at the time. I didn't make the most of all of it. I loved some of the education and the learning, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no idea of who I was or where I was going, really. And I think that's quite normal for lots of 18-year-olds now when I reflect back on it. But I was anxious at the time, and I think my parents were quite anxious. But I did settle down by going to Southampton University at the end and doing a degree in psychology and you know, actually completing that. But I was older, you know, it was when I was 20 to when I was 23. So, you know, I was ready for it by then, and I was more inspired or more focused to know what I was doing. So I'm always wary of that now when I'm teaching 18-year-olds. There's a real mixed bag. You're in a real different state of your life. There's lots of people who are still really children at that age and need a lot of help and support, a lot of emotional support, as well as, you know, pastoral support, as well as teaching kind of things. But there's also 18-year-olds who are really mature and ready for, you know, ready for all sorts and up for everything. And some universities, Swansea in particular, has a real mix of people along that range that I've got in undergraduate classes, which is you know, challenging to teach, but really fun to do. You know, although I might be professor now, I'm not going to be one of those professors who doesn't teach. I love it. I still love it now. So that's come from, you know, having parents that teach, I think, and valuing it and telling me from a young age, and perhaps seeing the normalness of teaching as well in those parties with teachers coming around.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, I remember I had a teacher, a Welsh teacher, who lived 2 or 3 doors up the road from me. And I remember, and I found this in an old diary from, I think it was Christmas 1987. And I'd mentioned that we'd broken up at lunchtime, and there'd been a service at the cathedral in Llandaff. And then and I'd mentioned that all of these teachers, and I actually listed them all, that half a dozen or more, had all gone to his house, you know, in the afternoon. It was like, oh, teachers going into another teacher's house, you know, how decadent, you know. And it's quite funny, really. So but I think you're right, and I think that there is something that you have to remember, which is that we were all students once, and therefore if, you know, you were one of those students who really relied on and depended on and cherished those interactions and the help and support from university lecturers, if you then were to become 20 or 30 years later a very sort of distant professor who doesn't like teaching, then in that sense there's something that's sold out. There's something that doesn't align. And although sometimes, like everything, you know, occasionally it's over, the marking can be overwhelming, but I never lose touch of a student. The highlight of my day is invariably when a student will email, because I know I can help them, and they might say, I've got an exam next week and I'm a bit worried, and I know that I'm able to attend to that issue.
Yeah.
And they've come to me and they've reached out to me. And that is the most important, you know, no matter how many wonderful books or articles or podcasts or anything that you can do, that on that level, person to person level. And I think it provided that is borne in mind, then actually you can have a really comfortable and in many cases, very kind of like two-way career.
And I think you're right. And I think that perhaps comes a bit, doesn't it, from our Lampeter upbringing, because it was small enough. And the lecturers, you know, and I think on most courses I know, were really dedicated to their subject and to their students. You know, they were they were really keen on helping the students. They were all very different characters and different backgrounds, but they shared a common interest on the whole, I think, as really trying to support the students. And I remember getting, you know, Southampton was good, but I think I got far more attention at Lampeter, you know, from the lecturers that really helped. And I think that underpins, you're right, the way I do now. I really would hate to have huge classes where I don't have the time or as well, you know, being given the time to talk to individuals, because the individual support or small group support is where it's at with teaching. That works really well. There's nothing wrong in having a big group to introduce a topic to, but the real teaching and learning comes when you can help those individuals and small group situations. And again, you know, Lampeter was great for doing that.
And what about outside of academic study as well? I mean, for me, both before Lampeter and during it, you know, I was a huge radio listener, and music was so important to my identity. So, you know, did you have any, maybe in film or, you know, sport? Were there any particular influences, non-academic influences?
I think, again, you know, Lampeter made a big difference for me with that, because when I was at sixth form, perhaps from... sort of the end of school to sixth form, I really got into progressive rock music. So that was Marillion. And then you find out there's other bands a bit like them. There's Pendragon and IQ. There's new trendier bands like Porcupine Tree. But, you know, perhaps Genesis and Pink Floyd were the original kind of bands of that from the 70s, and, you know, a number of other bands as well. But that's the kind of sound I really liked. But really, at sixth form, I was a lone prog rock fan that got made fun of a bit, you know, in a jolly kind of way, that, you know, prog rock's a bit... I wasn't hard enough to be the heavy metal person, and I wasn't, you know, trendy enough to like the pop music. I was somewhere in between the two. And then when I went to Lampeter, I found other people who liked progressive rock music for the first time ever. It was brilliant. I remember going to see Meridian at St David's Hall in Cardiff on a brilliant journey with... three other Lampeter people. Hugh took us out in his car from Lampeter on a really snowy afternoon in January 1994 to go and watch them do their whole album of Brave from start to finish. But, you know, we had to be brave going in Hugh's car across, and he didn't want to take the motorway away. He was from Merthyr Tydfil. He knew the routes down the back. And I remember at some point opening a farmer's field gate to go across a snowy like track, because it was going to be a shortcut there. We did, you know, we got there just about in time, and we did come back by the motorway and the A road. But I remember the whole thing, you know, the whole experience of doing that, no matter how perhaps dangerous it was really fun. It was brilliant. It was a real adventure. And to do it over something that I loved, and, you know, Marillion in particular has been, you know, behind all of my life from school through to now. You know, they're still going now, and they're the soundtrack to my life, really. So they've helped me through difficult times. Their music's there in good times as well. So I always remember that trip. I also, you know, related to that, another Lampeter story was when that album came out in 1994, I remember going to buy it in Aberystwyth so I could get it on the day it came out, on a bus journey that went to, you had to change at Aberaeron and then get a double-decker bus to Aberystwyth along that beautiful coastline path, road, which, you know, is quite windy again. But I remember listening to it on Walkman stereo on the way back. I think it had orange mufflers on the headphone bits, and listening to that whole album. And when I listen to that album now, I can see myself on that upstairs of that double-decker bus coming back from Aberystwyth in the dark in February, having bought that from some shop or other in Aberystwyth, coming back. You know, it used to take nearly 2 hours, didn't I think, to get from Aberystwyth back to Lampeter. So I could hear the whole album twice. And, you know, it just, again, is that feelings and those moods and seeing those roads and those lovely coastline and the beautiful hills alongside that album has stayed with me, you know, forever. And when I listen to that album now, I remember those times. But it was really nice overall to find other people who liked similar similar music for the first time in my life.
Yeah, and there's something, isn't there, about journeys and destinations and how you imagine that the destination is the important bit. But actually, it's, I mean, I've got some wonderful memories in the same way of, and it probably was around that kind of period. I seem to recall going with the Film Society. They used to run a minibus excursion on a Thursday night. So this would have been October 93. And I went to see The Fugitive because The Fugitive came out right at the start of term. So I didn't get a chance to see it in Cardiff before I went to Lampeter. And of course, I thought, oh, I'm in Lampeter now till Christmas and I won't be able to go to the cinema. And then there was this poster in the arts hall, or in the student union, saying, you know, on Thursday night, leave at 6 o'clock or whatever it is, and we'll take you down to the UCI in Swansea. But the journey is what I remember, and the conversations in the bus and the excitement as we look forward to the film and then on the way back. And I, even now, I remember the minibus driver stopping off for petrol at one of the service stations near Swansea. And what I remember is Bob Harris, who was still on Radio 1 in those days. In fact, I was able to because I think he left Radio 1 just around that period. But I remember listening to him on the radio, and we probably got back about 1 in the morning. And it just felt really precious. And it's one of those days that, and whenever I watch the film, and it's one of my favourite films, and I wonder if it's my favourite film because of that journey and because of the ritual around it. And to this day, I'm always taken back. And I even wonder, and that this would be a great sort of extension of this project that I'm doing now, I always think, you know, I probably got the stub somewhere and I saw it on a Thursday night sometime in October 1993. You know, who else was in the audience at that time? Are they looking back and thinking, you know, I had a really good evening that night? You know, and that's, for me, that there's something very special about those particular rites of passage and those events and the journeys and the bus journeys. So Lambeter may have been isolated, but the journey out was in itself rewarding. It wasn't just the fact that there was the city at the end of it.
Absolutely. I mean, again, that relates to the work I do now. Again, when older people give up driving, you know, there's loads of research about them not being able to connect to things that they need to do. So seeing family and friends, to get from A to B, to, you know, go to the post office, go to the doctors, even do nicer things like go to the pub and things. But actually, when I talk to them again, if you talk to them long enough in interviews, you'll find that they miss other things as well. So they miss being able to just go for a journey for its own sake sometimes, or the actual parts of the journey, seeing other people as they go on that journey. It's almost like a third space, you know, why we like perhaps sitting in coffee shops and things like that and watching the world go all around us. So it comes back to the idea that the mundaneness is as important as the actual event sometimes. And sometimes they're wrapped up in both, aren't they? Because you're right. I think with that trip to see Marillion at St. David's Hall in Cardiff, the journey, I mean, I remember bits about the concert, but I probably remember exactly the same amount of things about the trip as I do. And there's a petrol station in that on the way back, I think, at 1 a.m. And we all chipped in petrol to help Hugh pay for the journey. So I remember that. I can see that, you know, it's dark and freezing and the, you know, bit of snow melting on the side of the roads. And I just think that's amazing that you can, you know, remember all those different things, those feelings, those emotions. And so if people can't get out and about so much in later life, as I find in lots of the research I do for, you know, perfectly ordinary, normal things that happen to us all as we age, the things they miss are not always the destination, but it's the journey as well. And the things that you know, make the whole thing an experience. And I'm very keen on making sure, you know, that that's captured. And, you know, you talk to people who go in community transport to events for their luncheon clubs or days out by the sea again in later life. They talk as much about the journey as they do the thing they're going to, the chats they have on a journey. I remember I had a PhD student who carried out some research on community transport, and she was really interested in one chap who didn't say anything on these journeys, often lots of talking and things like that. There's one chap who didn't say anything. So she was a bit, you know, worried about it. And when she came to interview them all afterwards, it was him who spoke most passionately about the journey. He didn't really say very much. He was quite a shy, you know, quiet, retiring chap. But for him, it was absolutely, you know, vitally important just to sit there and listen to the conversations, to see the world going on around. That was the highlight of his week. He loved it. And I think, you know, that again struck for me how important it is to have these, you know, what we might call third spaces, to sit there, to have time to think and ponder. And bus journeys, train journeys are really good for that. Car journeys can be, but, you know, you're looking at the world going on around you outside. It allows your mind to wander, to think about things. And again, perhaps in lockdown over the last year or so, we haven't had time to do that kind of thing. I mean, I've used it as vital time to think about work and stuff. I might have some marking out, or I might have some, you know, some peer-reviewed journal article to look at or something. But sometimes I don't do any of that because I've got it out in front of me. I'm sat on the train going to a meeting in London, but I'm looking out the window and just letting my mind wander and think about these things. I think it's a really important, you know, almost psychologically liminal space or something like that that's good for your soul and who you are. And some of those things you remember again when you think back in the past, some of those very mundane, ordinary parts of a journey.
Yeah, and you find it as well with doing a degree, for example, because there are some students who, and I can't blame them for this, want to get the piece of paper, they want to get the qualification. Of course they do. And it's a passport to a job. And it may well be that when they leave the lecture room, they're not then thinking, they're not in any sort of existential angst about the fact that we've, you know, been looking at the death of God or a module on death and the afterlife and raising these big questions. But there are other students, and plenty of them, who do. And it's not about the degree classification. Well, it is to some extent, but it's what they do along the way, and it's what they learn in the skills which they can use for the whole of their life. And in that sense, it's the degree is a means to an end, and it's an end, but the journey there is as important as what you get at the end of it. There's no point short-circuiting it. Some people might say, oh, you know, I wish the degree was shorter, or I just want it over with. And I get that, but I also think that whatever you do or don't do along the way really informs your personality. And I always joke that, you know, I say to my students, you're not going to, in 20 years' time, you're not going to say, I wish I'd gone to fewer lectures. You might say you wish you'd gone to more, but you want to seize that moment because you're not going to get that chance again. So make the most of it every step of the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it you know, talking like that, it reminds me again, you know, of why perhaps Lampeter's really special. It was sometimes those conversations, yeah, I found it quite an intellectual place. People like to talk about the things they were studying. So there was often a nice space after a lecture, or, you know, it might be in the Union Bar, or I remember in sort of spring kind of time, sitting outside and conversations would be about all sorts of things, about life, the universe and everything, until 3 or 4 in the morning. I remember, you know, seeing the sun beginning to come back up and things like that. And you'd lost track of time just chatting about really interesting things, some funny conversations, but also some really poignant, interesting conversations. And it was about, you know, defining how you understand or interpret the world a little bit in conversations with other people, and how you fit into life and how you fit into other people. And it's not again until much later on you realize that that's a really important part of the journey of you know, part of your growing up, part of doing a degree. And you know, it does influence the way you think in future life. But you know, I do look back on it and wish I'd made more of it somehow. I had more of those conversations or part them more in my mind somehow, so you know keeping a detailed account of them, because they were really special and precious. So again, that's what we tell in our students now, you know, don't just think the lectures and the contact time is all about it, but you know, log everything that you do somehow, or have chats, you know. And if we move lots of things online, how do we still create a space so that the students can chat to each other and bond with each other and talk about the course? So that, you know, that's like I said, it's the sort of informal chit chat around the edge can really shape who you are and how you respond to the course. And yeah, of course, there's students who want to just get a degree and do it as quickly and easily as possible. But, you know, despite them paying a fortune for the degree now, I still find lots of people wanting to get more out of their degree. And it's not just drinking in a pub, and it's not just the sport, which, you know, is still part of the journey. It's also the conversations just around the margins of between that, the margins between the social stuff and the academic stuff and the chit chat around the edge. And when students are in that zone, it's brilliant. That was my favorite time, I think.
Yeah, because I know that, I think on Radio 4 on the PM program about a year ago, they had a feature on people's lockdown diaries. Yeah. It was people saying, you know, I'm in lockdown, I don't want to be in this, so I'm going to record everything I do. But actually, it's the non-lockdown, it's the so-called normal, it's the counterpoint to all of that, that I find really interesting. Because, you know, when I was young and I had, I've always kept a diary, but I would always start them in like half-term school holidays. And they were not the representative periods. So I'd have all these things about what I would watch on TV and the cartoons or whatever, you know, that when I was young I'd watch. But I didn't have so much about my school day. So I now ensure that, you know, I've never missed a day in, I think, the last time I didn't have an entry recorded was in 1993. So I've been going at this now for decades. And I think in later years, of course, you look back on some of these mundane things and you realize that these are priceless. I mean, a good example is that, you know, I used to write a lot less than I do now, but some of my entries would consist of, you know, mentioning in Lampeter, went to the cottage garden for lunch or went to the King's Head. Now, some years ago, I was thinking, oh, you know, people might think, if not, you know, if I ever publish them or something, people think, oh, it's a bit mundane. It's like, who cares about that? But I realize that I don't do those sort of things anymore. I don't go to the pub really as much. Well, not, I don't really, obviously, can't at the moment due to lockdown. But, you know, but in a way, that's an interesting sense of what I did with my time. So that the stuff that I thought might be a bit trivial isn't at all, because it says something important about the way in which I socialized, I spent, I accorded my time, where I hung out and the sort of conversations that I had there. And a lot of those I can piece together. So it's interesting is with the passage of time, and fascinating with what you do with older people as part of your research, and the way in which those prosaic events turn out to be life-changing. And I'm guessing that in many cases, there are lots of those what-if scenarios. Do you find that rather than just remembering the things that they did and when the children were born or when they learned to drive or holidays or the set that they went on, I'm guessing they also remember the things that they had a chance to do but didn't quite take the plunge, and decades on, they're regretting it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, in relation to what life is like now, quite often, and women in particular, you know, who perhaps gave up work when they had kids and didn't pursue a career, that does come out quite a lot, particularly when they look like what life is like now. Oh, yeah, look, you know, I should have done that. I really enjoyed doing that. You know, I really enjoyed doing that, you know, doing the teaching or something like that. And I just didn't, it was the norm to not take it on in their day. That comes out quite a lot. And interesting, a lot of women talking about how much they did enjoy work when they did it, but gave it up and then really missed bits of, and again, you know, but, you know, without labouring the point, it really is the bits they miss about it are the chatting to other people, the passing the time of day, the feeling that you're doing something useful for society and you know, and earning your own money. And you know, we all know what that feels like a little bit, but it's not until you can't do that or you reflect on a time where you haven't been able to do that that people, you know, mention quite a lot about that as an issue. But yeah, I mean, it comes up quite a lot about people taking, you know, different pathways in life or moving to different places. And people talking about what, you know, what if something had happened quite differently. But often it's quite positive. So, you know, or things, you know, even people who've, I don't know, lost their job or you know, lost a lot of money or, you know, lost a lot of money on a house or things like that. I remember some conversations with older people and they tend to think, well, it all ended up OK in the end. You know, I'm still here, you know, and it they do talk about, it, you know, making them feel stronger and having to adapt to these kind of things. No doubt it might have been easier if those things hadn't happened. But, you know, things are still OK as it is. So difficult events, when they reflect on them in the past, they've been able to overcome, and that helps them a little bit with some of the problems they face in later life that again are quite normal parts of later life, like losing close friends and family or loved ones. Difficult and horrible as it is, you know, some of the challenges they've been through in the past, they're able to use some of that resilience, if you like, to be able to help with those difficult times. It doesn't make it, you know, 100 times easier, but, you know, and perhaps we don't always have that in earlier parts of our life, because we're, you know, we live more day to day than perhaps that you have to do in later life. We've got a bit more time for reflection. So there's a little bit of that, but, you know, it really is often about the ordinary mundaneness of stuff. And it looks like it's a really important thing about work, but when you talk to them about what they miss about work, it's not work per se, it's the psychological associations with it or the social bits of it, the chatting to people and the feeling that you're doing something useful, again, which people miss in later life.
Yeah, it's putting your signature on something in a way that, yeah, we were saying before, I think before we started that some years ago I was doing a job where I was dealing with lots of module and program specs. Well, it's an important job, but you know, at the time I was thinking, does it really have my fingerprints on them? And sometimes in life we don't have the luxury to think, oh, well, I'll only do the things that I want to do. So you have to do it. You bite the bullet. But sometimes you think with all these other things that may be part of my job that I need to do and want to do, but you know, don't have time to do. And it is interesting sometimes how you find your way through adversity, through challenges, and then sometimes you then have a better sense, which I do think holds you in better stead later on in life for making those big decisions and knowing which particular pathway to follow. And it doesn't mean to say that you don't make mistakes, very far from it, but it does mean that you have the mechanism in place, you have the resilience, maybe the resources in place to know how to apprehend those particular challenges when they happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about my trajectory through university. You know, if I did, you know, almost 2 years at Lampeter, I didn't come out with anything, and then went to Southampton and did another 3 years. That could seem like complete wasted time if you're only focusing on the outcome, but it wasn't. I've taken, you know, now when I think about all the things, you know, it's almost like having had 2 degrees now, or 1.5. It's brilliant. I've learned all sorts of things about, you know, not just subject specific stuff, which is really important for what I do now, but also, you know, about life and meeting loads of people and having a great time and having lived in a, you know, a big city and having lived in a town in the middle of the countryside. I think it's wonderful. I think if I look back now, it was, you know, really important to pick up on all this. And again, it's about, you know, we're too focused on the destination and not on the journey loads of the time. And it's on the journey where you pick up all the important bits about life, really. If you get a destination at the end that's also good, that's a bonus rather than, you know, what you should just be striving for. And I don't really know always how to tell my own kids that when they keep thinking about, you know, they're 15 and 13 now, and they can't wait to be independent and leave home and all this, and that's quite normal. But at the same time, I want them to tell them, just, you know, enjoy what you've got now and make the most of some of those things now, because, you know, I loved my childhood at that age. And, you know, you'll never have some of those experiences and feelings again. So just make the most of them. Don't wish your life away, I suppose, is the phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. And do you think that the experience that you had of perhaps starting a degree program, finding that maybe it wasn't quite the right thing and starting somewhere else, did that make you more determined perhaps to go into academia as a profession? Because, you know, you experienced something didn't quite work out, but then you thought, okay, well, there's a lesson here. And it's interesting that you've now had this amazing career leading up to professor in this, but that may not have been what you could have ever have imagined happening, I'm guessing, way back in the mid 90s.
Yeah, it probably helps, doesn't it? I think you're right. I think it's like I said, I probably always thought I'd be in education of some kind or other, and possibly just spending that little bit longer amount of time. Again, I started to especially being a bit more mature at Southampton, I started to really, you know, get into the subject more then. And yeah, like I said, be start thinking, well, I'd really like to do some research in this. I'd like to find out more. I don't really believe what I'm reading is the truth, if you know what I mean. And then realizing, you know, that perhaps there isn't any one truth, and the excitement that comes with unpicking all of that. I think had I just read one degree at 18 to 21, I wouldn't have been so advanced in my thinking that I could have gone on and done a PhD, really. And it really helped pause things. That's why I'm a big fan, I think, of having degrees at least 3 years, if not 4 years, because it's such a maturing process in terms of your thinking, let alone who you are, that really helped me be able to give me the confidence, if you like, to go on and do a PhD and do further study. Because without that, I probably would have just, you know, would have fallen into a fine education career somewhere, which would have been quite good, but it probably wouldn't have been as multifaceted as an academic career is, or take you to such interesting places. Yeah. I mean, can do, but yeah. And so pausing things and slowing things down a bit, as that did, you know, even though perhaps it didn't feel like at the time, really helped, I think. And again, that's an important life lesson. You know, take your time with things. Don't chase something and dive into it straight away. You know, reflect and take your time.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because there are occasions when it's very easy to follow a particular path, and you know with certainty what you're going to do. The student who knows what they're going to do their degree, well, they know what they're going to do at the end of their degree. They're going to go into teaching or whatever profession. And in a way, that's always a bit disappointing because, you know, sometimes it's exciting to actually say, ah, well, the degree has taken me somewhere I didn't expect it to. This is a good chance for me to reflect and to see what is the right thing rather than what I thought was the right thing based on what other people had told me or what I experienced secondhand through a teacher or another family member.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit about making the most of the opportunities, isn't it, as well, where they arise or you know, if something bubbles up to the surface that's interesting, it's about focusing on that for you know, a little while and making more of that. So, you know, when there's something you find interesting that you've come across, go and find out more about it. You know, I really like that now as a lecturer when students come to me and sometimes they're a bit worried, you know, should we go and bother him about knowing more about that subject, or I, you know, or even I didn't quite get it, but it looked quite interesting. I can you come and meet me on Zoom for an hour? And I think, yeah, of course I can. And it, you know, and if people ask me now for a paper or you know, a thesis or something I've written, it takes all my willpower not to send it back to them immediately and go, yeah, of course you can. Have a look at it. Let me know what you think, because it's you know, it's wonderful to think that you can inspire somebody else's thinking, particularly along lines that they perhaps hadn't thought about before. So I had a student finish their master's recently through really difficult times she'd been through with lockdown and family issues, and she was a nurse during lockdown, so had to work really hard in hospital. But she managed to do a dissertation recently for her master's, and at the start of it she put and they always acknowledge you, you know, good students do, but she did write, you know, thanks for opening my eyes to, you know, environments around gerontology, you know, and thank me for that. And I thought that, you know, that really made my day. I felt really privileged and honored. She hadn't really thought about, you know, as you age, how much the environment around you, your home, your neighborhood, you know, affects who you are and what the things you are you can do. You know, and she'd been inspired to study that for her dissertation, and it'll always be with her now in her, you know, nursing work, I guess, moving forward, thinking, you know, how do we make the ward more age friendly, for example, or something like that. And you know, it's not just me doing that alone, but I was a catalyst in getting her to think like that. And that's what a wonderful thing that is, to be able to inspire somebody else like that. And I was inspired by good teachers like that in the past, and you know, I hope that continues in the future. And again, if we just concentrate on the destination, you miss a bit of that journey where you might suddenly latch on something that inspires you.
Yeah, and I've got a few more philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up, Charles. And in a way, I think we answered some of it, or I could probably imagine what your answer will be. But are your memories, would you say, predominantly positive ones?
Yeah, really positive. And actually, Chris, I suffer from rose-tinted glasses massively. I always think the past was a million times better. And that's why I keep in a diary sometimes. And I didn't keep them as well as you've done, but I have got bits here and there. And I love looking back on them. And actually, they're helpful in reminding me then it wasn't always quite as great as I think it was. You know, that girlfriend I had at school, you know, that I now think was absolutely amazing, actually, we fell apart and argued quite a lot. You know, I've forgotten about those negative bits. Or you know, I think about my school life and how much fun the, you know, doing English was. I wish I could go back to reading books or watching films like you do and having time to write about it. And when I look back, you know, at some of the diaries, I'm fed up with doing that. I don't want to do that anymore for GCSE. So I really suffer from that. But as long as I realize I suffer from that rose tinted glasses thing, I think it's healthy enough that I can deal with it. But I do suffer it. You know, I think about my time in Lampeter and even my time in Southampton, I absolutely love it. I can't remember not enjoying bits of it, but really there was times, you know, I like I said, I was probably quite immature as an 18-year-old going to Lampeter, and I was terribly homesick, but I don't really remember those feelings particularly. I remember feeling okay and not feeling homesick once I'd found people I could chat to and get along with, and those, you know, beginning to have really interesting conversations. So that, you know, that's really positive. But I'm fascinated by how much rose-tinted glasses I have about the past and how I always think it was amazing and brilliant. And I play tunes from the time and it brings back all these happy memories. But of course, there was difficult times as well, but they seem to go out of my mind for some reason.
Yeah,
I think that's fascinating.
Well, I mean, actually, that leads to the next question, which is whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. Although it sounds like in your case, you say, I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, my mind isn't doing very, very good. But no, there are some negative experiences I've had in the past. And again, you know, I think sometimes I do visit them in my mind or use a piece of music to visit them because, again, I think sometimes it helps you move on. It helps you think about how, you know, at least I'm not in that difficult place anyway. Everyone ends up in difficult places at some point or other. And, you know, without sounding, you know, trite about these things, I think there is lots of learning to do that and lots of realizing how lucky you are to have come through it and learn something from it. And that I'm not in that space anymore and things are a little bit better. So I do try and be positive about it. So, although I've got rose-tinted glasses and everything seems amazing in the past, every now and then I'll revisit a difficult time deliberately to just go, you know, a bit of space to go through it and think how, you know, I've moved on since then.
And what about going back in that sense? Because obviously we know each other through the Lampeter Society Business Committee, but have you been back to Lampeter or Southampton, I guess, because obviously that's not far from your family home. But do you... ever return? Have you ever returned to Lampeter since you were there in the 90s?
Yeah, I return a lot and I really enjoy returning, you know, and seeing it all like it is now. And I know a lot of people struggle with that. My wife does, for example. She was at Lampeter, not that we met there and not that we were necessarily going out together when we were there, but we did see each other here and there, which is an interesting another story to have another time. But we ended up getting together afterwards. But you know, she had a great time there, probably better time than I had. And she did actually complete a degree there. But I'm not sure she needs to go and revisit it or see it even. So sometimes I go there on my own, you know, and she thinks it's funny that I have this connection and love for the place that she says, you know, it's not like that anymore. You know, that was then. She's really good at being able to park the past in the past and move forwards. And I'm the opposite. I completely live in the past and go back there and I sit on the same steps that I sat on when I and look out at the same views that I have, you know, back then. And I need to do that sometimes. I remember, you know, thinking about, you know, now becoming a professor about a year and a half, was it just before lockdown in February 2020? I'd been head of my research group for a while at Swansea and then I didn't get promoted and didn't get to take it on, and I was gutted for that. And I remember saying to my overarching faculty boss, you know, well, I'm going to take a week off to reflect on this, you know, I need a bit of time out. And so I went to Lampeter to reflect on that, or at least on one of the days, and it was brilliant. It was restorative for the soul. I sat in the cafe, I had lunch in Conti's, I just wandered around on my own around the space and I felt 100 times better. Somebody invited me to some yoga, I saw a lecturer talking to a student about her essay. I took a computer with me and did a, you know, a tiny bit of work, but not lots. But it just felt nice to be part of that place. It's restorative. But, you know, my wife doesn't need that. I see lots of people who still love Lampeter don't necessarily need to go back there. But I do. I have a need to go back there. Yeah. I don't know if you do, Chris.
Yeah, well, no, that's an interesting one in my case, because I was there for so long, because I was there for... The undergraduate days are the ones that I do put on the pedestal. And a few years ago, when I wasn't in contact with people on social media, then they were the people I missed. And I actually said in the talk that I gave the other evening, I said that, you know, in my afterlife, you know, if I could choose a particular community, you know, I know that particular period of my life was a really important and it's a restorative one. And the people there sort of helped me as I was starting to discover who I was at that age of, you know, 18. But I was there for 10 years. And yeah, I think I did, if I'm honest, I outgrew the place in the sense that by the end, the highlight was getting on the bus to Swansea on a Saturday to see films. Now, of course, I can integrate things a bit more because I live, I have a car. I didn't drive in those days, and I live around lots of cinemas, and I have, and I'm able to go to them. But I wasn't able to do that in the same way in Lampeter. But at the time, I didn't realise that, so I was kind of a bit frustrated in some ways. And I liked it there, but I was there for a long time, and I think I needed to see more of the world. And I think that it took me a long time, 16 years really, before I felt ready to go back. And yeah. I think it's because I had so much to unpack. And good and not so good in some ways. And I just think that I needed to go back on my terms. And having started these interviews, for example, it means that even if I go back and I find that for whatever reason, something you know horrible happened or I didn't like what I saw, that I've got enough almost validation, corroboration of all those wonderful times through these interviews, through those diaries. Yeah. Through, it's almost as though I've created enough of a cushion so that and when I went back, it was great. I had a lovely time. But my anticipation. But also, I also went back imagining. This is interesting, a bit naive of me. I imagined that all those people from all the 90s and so on would also be there.
Yeah,
that there would be a mixture of the curiosity and maybe the judgmental and the whole sort of like. So what have you been doing with your life? And that didn't happen at all. And they weren't there. And suddenly I realised that the people who were at the reunion, in many cases, were 60s and 70s and 80s graduates, not 90s. So in that sense, I suddenly realized that I built this thing up. I was going to see all these people again, and I didn't see them. And then I felt a bit of deflation, but also thought, I'm here. That's the important thing. I'm here. I'm not responsible for whether other people come or don't. And in some cases, it made me think that although they were wonderful people, in some cases, that, because I'm thinking of people who said they were going to go and they didn't. And I also thought that I loved their company, but they were a bit like that then. And I'd forgotten that about them, that they weren't always, they were lovely people, but they weren't always reliable. But in Lampeter, because it was so small, everybody was there. You had to go down the same bar every night and you'd always see people in the street and in Conti's and so on. But when, of course, people got busy lives and jobs and families, then really the need to go back and the ability to go back is lessened. And that made me just think, not in a bad way, but just in a more reflexive way about some of those days.
It's really interesting, isn't it? It's interesting how Lampeter has that quite uniquely, you know, having been at Southampton University and being an alumni of there, you know, it doesn't have the same pull or draw or connection to other people. Or maybe it's too big. You know, it just doesn't have the same feel as Lampeter does. And I think Lampeter was such a unique place of individual characters, both locals and students. And even though the university is perhaps a shadow of its former self now, especially in terms of numbers, it's still got a unique, unusual feel about the place that makes it feel creative and different. It's just nice to be part of. And again, you know, I don't know how much of that is because of my relationship to it, but perhaps I didn't go back to Lampeter for years. That, you know, it's only when we moved to Swansea that I went back there. So it's only in the last eight and a bit years that I've been, you know, perhaps once or twice a year, just go back on my own or sometimes drag the family there to have a wander around. And although it is different, I still love being there. And I think, you know, as I've matured as well, there's also just the love of being in a really quiet, nice place with where you can breathe really clean air around the place. But it's still having that, you know, in such a unique place, having such a unique university campus in the middle of nowhere, it's brilliant to see that and you know, be able to go up there. It just feels nice. And like I said, I do like to, and it's often thinking about the things from the past, it's often, yeah, you're right that the people weren't always as reliable as you hoped they were. They weren't always as interested as they were. They were sometimes more drunk than they ought to have been and not quite as interesting when they were drunk as they thought they were. So it wasn't always as great as you think, but somehow the feelings and the moods of the place are still there. And when I go back there and sit there in the same place as I've sat before, I can still feel those moods and feelings, and that's really important to me and helps me, you know, feel better, I think. And you know, something about the light across the campus or onto those hills behind or even down the main high street past, you know, the Black Lion and places, it just feels nice. And hearing the clock of the town hall and things like that, those little things just help me connect back to a part of my life that I, at least with rose-tinted glasses, think it was amazing. So it makes me feel better.
Yeah, and it's very interesting as well that some of the people who were my closest friends, in some cases, I'm not really in touch with as much as I thought I might be. That they appear on Facebook, for example, but I'm not in touch with them that much. But there are other people who were perhaps on the periphery in those who were friends of friends who I've connected with on Facebook because I knew who they were, but I didn't know them all that well. And they're now some of my very closest friends, and I'm in touch with them all the time. So that's another interesting thing, that the unexpectedness of having those wonderful contacts with people and with the place and all those things in common, but it's never gone the way I could have expected it to.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a really, really good point. And again, a good life lesson, isn't it? It's exactly the same's happened to me. The people I'm in contact with now that I get along with who were at Lampeter at the time and not the people I was closest to at the time. Some of them I'm not even in contact with at all. So you never know, do you? And it just shows how people change over time and perhaps how, you know, people, you don't always know the best of people, not even in a small environment where you're hanging out with them, you know, it and changes over time. But yeah, exactly the same for me. And even, you know, I've got along with a couple of people that I wasn't at Lampeter with at the time or didn't, you know, didn't know I was at Lampeter at the time with, well, a bit like you. And there's a chap in Swansea that I know, and we must have been at Lampeter at the same time, but I didn't know him then. And we get along well now. There's something about that connection, whether Lampeter makes you have to be more chatty and more open. So if you do bump into someone, they're more likely to say hello and chat to you. I don't know. But, you know, there's a couple of people who, you know, you end up realizing, oh, you're a Lampeter graduate. I see. Oh, I was there. You know, and then you end up being friends with them, even though you didn't know them at the time.
Yeah. And so we talk about the negotiation between the past, the present and the future. But how interesting that going back and revisiting a place and being in contact with all these people. But actually, it's new conversations and it's new trajectories and new friendships that are built up. So yeah, it's not the people you imagined that you'd be in touch with. And actually, you suddenly realize that we all grow. And if we'd all stayed in Lampeter all those years ago, perhaps those friendships would have evolved in just the same way that, you know, you're away for 15 or 20 years, but then you go back. And then suddenly you find that you've got an awful lot in common with people who you barely knew in those days, but you realize that they do appear, you know, in my diary, that these people appear there. It's just that they weren't the primary friends. And so there's growth. And I think that's the really positive part in this. It's not just a case of, you know, the rose-tinted lens is an important part of it, but there's also the sense of a future direction and continuing degrees of friendships.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly, isn't it? You've got to navigate the past, the present and the future all at once, really, I think, to make life work. And that comes out again in my research with older people reflecting on their lives. And again, the idea that older people don't think about their future or only think about death or are preparing for death is not the case, you know, at all. People have got all sorts of dreams and ambitions, sometimes related on things they've done in the past. Sometimes it's just visiting, a bit like, you know, I do with Lampeter, visiting a place. If they can't do that, you know, again, that's something fascinating to show them on the internet. This is what that place looks like that you went to, you know, in the 60s or 50s, or this is that place that, you know, you've always wanted to visit, even though you can't do it. And that's opened up a whole new world for them to be able to connect to stuff that's sometimes related to their past, but you're connecting them to it in the present. And also, you know, helps them think about where they want to go in the future, or to you know, to chat about the future or to make something of the future. So living your life in all those three spheres seems to be quite healthy.
Well, I'm going to finish with what will sound a very crass question now, because you've actually just answered it, but it's whether you consider yourself, Charles, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think overall, you see, because I always think about rose-tinted, I have those rose-tinted glasses when I think about the past, I am a looking back kind of person, but I do it in a healthy kind of way so that I know it's got rose-tinted glasses, which enables me, therefore, to use some of that looking backness to help me look forward. So if that kind of answers the question, I'm allowed a little bit of both. That's really the way it is.
No, Charles, that has been, Professor Charles, that has been an absolutely fantastic opportunity to catch up. Thank you for being my guest this week.
I've loved it. Thank you, Chris. Great to chat.